Today on ID the Future, we're happy to bring you another interview with Dr. Tom Woodward, host of the Universe Next Door syndicated radio broadcast. In conjunction with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, Dr. Woodward regularly interviews CSC scientists and scholars on various aspects of the debate over Darwinian evolution and intelligent design.
And welcome to the Universe Next Door for a very special program emphasizing the release, which has now happened, of one of the most significant science books of our time. And that is not hype. I think it's right on the money. We're talking about the book that we have been heralding for about a month and a half, and that's called Darwin's Doubt, subtitled The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design, authored by Stephen C. Meyer. He has pledged to be with us on the program very soon. I think right now as we speak, he's getting ready to go on several national network radio and TV programs. Network News is covering this. And we have so many exciting bits of information that are flowing to us. But we have the very important expert on this book. He has been working alongside Dr. Stephen Meyer. His name is Casey Luskin. He has been for a number of years on the staff of the Discovery Institute, and it's under the leadership of Discovery Institute that much of the work, research, and really scholarly writing on intelligent design has been taking place. And we want to thank you, Casey Luskin, for joining us in the midst of your very busy schedule. How are you today?
I'm very good. Thanks for having me on, Dr. Woodward.
I appreciate you coming alongside us as we're really diving into this incredible book. I mean, I have already jotted so many wows. That's one of my traditions is when I am in a book, I keep a pen or pencil handy and it's very quick, W-O-W, and it's accurate in my thinking to what I'm experiencing. Your work with Dr. Meyer was so helpful to him. I know you assisted him in research in so many areas and fact checking. How long has this book more or less been in the works?
Oh boy, that's probably a question that I don't even know the answer to, but it definitely goes back many years. I think that Dr. Meyer got interested in the topic of the Cambrian explosion and intelligent design probably back in the early 2000s, if not even sooner. When he exactly started this book, I'm not completely sure. It was many years ago. I know that Dr. Meyer had an article in the book, Darwinism, Design, and Public Education, on the Cambrian explosion back in 2003. This book, Darwin's Doubt, is much more expansive and far more in-depth in its arguments than that 2003 article that he wrote. But certainly at least 5 or 6 years, and in the interim, he even published another book because he's been working on this for so long. I think that Signature in the Cell probably had its birth in the midst of when this Darwin's Doubt was being worked on to a certain extent.
Very good. And of course, the earlier book was a substantial blockbuster in its own right, Signature in the Cell. Signature in the Cell, of course, approaching the question of how did the very first life form come to be, and do any of the naturalistic theories really convey any convincing account of how that happened? And of course, Dr. Meyer had thoroughly analyzed every single major, and I would say many of the minor theoretical ideas on those scenarios, those just-so stories as to how the first cell came into existence. He made a very compelling and strong case for intelligent design of the first cell. And now he's moving up to the next level, the Cambrian explosion, the level of rock that is found in many parts of the world, but especially is now exciting to convey the story of the Cambrian explosion because we have these new species popping into existence out of nowhere in the Chinese shale, the yellow shale of southern China in Zhejiang. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but hopefully it's close. And then, of course, the Burgess Shale of Canada, the British Rockies there in Alberta. Dr. Meyer has been on our program, and he's told me just recently he'll be glad to join us here in the next couple of weeks. But you have graciously, Casey Luskin, stepped in to kind of give us the sense of not only the book's content, but how momentous this publication is. Some have even said this may be one of the most significant scientific books of our era. And I'm 100% convinced of that after reading just the first half of the book. What, in a nutshell, is Dr. Meyer trying to accomplish in this book? What is he trying to bring to the table in Darwin's Doubt?
Well, I think what he's trying to show is that the standard neo-Darwinian model of evolution faces some major problems in explaining some of the most important events in the history of animal life. In this particular case, in Darwin's Doubt, he looks at the Cambrian explosion, which, of course, is an event that took place in the fossil record where virtually all of the major animal groups called phyla appear in a geological blink of the eye in the Cambrian period, and there are no clear evolutionary precursors to those phyla earlier in the record. And so many, even Darwin recognized that this was a problem for his own theory. He was aware of this sort of abrupt and explosive appearance of animal fossils in his own time. At that time, it wasn't called the Cambrian explosion because this strata at that time was called the Silurian strata, and it has later been renamed the Cambrian. But this has been a long-standing problem for evolutionary biology. And so what Dr. Meyer says is, look, this problem that goes way back to the time of Darwin, it's relevant today. And the reason it's been a problem for all these years is because it hits at the major deficiency of neo-Darwinian theory, which is the inability to produce new complex features, as we now know from our knowledge of DNA, new complex features that require new information in order for them to form. Neo-Darwinian theory cannot produce the information required for the complex features we see in living animals. So this is sort of hitting at basically the fundamental deficiency of Darwinian theory, but he just uses the Cambrian explosion as, I think, one of the best examples of where that deficiency becomes clear.
With us today on the phone, Casey Luskin. He is on staff at the Discovery Institute. He holds graduate degrees in both sciences and also the law. Give us a little bit of your academic background. I know that you have studied science, both undergraduate and graduate, and then went on for a law degree. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. I got my bachelor's and master's degrees in earth sciences from the University of California, San Diego, and did quite a bit of research at Scripps Institution for Oceanography and took a lot of evolution while I was there as well. So I got a pretty healthy background in evolutionary biology. And then I went on to decided I needed to get a real job. So I went to law school and got a law degree. So now I'm an attorney as well.
Very good. Well, today we're focusing on this new book, which you assisted Steve Meyer greatly on. Let me just read a quote. I pulled this off the internet just a short time ago. It's from Mount Holyoke College. I think it's one of the Seven Sisters, kind of the quasi Ivy League schools in New England. Mark McMenamin, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correct, but he is a paleontologist, and he said, "It is hard for us paleontologists, steeped as we are in the tradition of Darwinian analysis, to admit that neo-Darwinian explanations for the Cambrian explosion have failed miserably." Whoa. And then he says, "New data acquired in recent years, instead of solving Darwin's dilemma, have rather made it worse. Meyer describes the dimensions of the problem with clarity and precision. His book is a game changer for the study of evolution and evolutionary biology. Stephen Meyer points us in the right direction as we seek a new theory for the origin of Cambrian animal phyla." Whoa! When I read that, I was shocked. I mean, pleasantly shocked. This is a game changer book, I think. Would you see signs of that, Casey?
I definitely think so, because I think that it's, first of all, the most up-to-date and comprehensive critique of neo-Darwinian theory. You're going to get all of these different threads of peer-reviewed scientific articles and really scientific concepts that have been around in some cases for decades that have some of the most prestigious academic pedigrees, going back to papers written by the famous evolutionary biologist John Maynard Smith in Nature back in the 1960s and 1970s, to the Wistar Symposium back in the 1950s, where people were beginning to realize that neo-Darwinian theory cannot explain how new animal body plans arise and new complex features arise. And Meyer, what he's done is Dr. Meyer has traced these different ideas through the years and showed how, you know, right up to the present day, these problems have not been solved by Darwinian evolution. In fact, they've gotten much worse. And he looks at it from all different angles, not just from the standpoint of DNA and information biology, but of course also from the standpoint of fossils. And this is why it's really, I think, encouraging to see somebody like Dr. Mark McMenamin from Mount Holyoke endorsing the book Darwin's Doubt, because he is a pre-Cambrian paleontologist who's an expert in the fossils of the era that took place in the Cambrian explosion. And Dr. Meyer goes into great detail, the fossil record. I know, Dr. Woodward, you've already read the first third or so of the book, so you know the section that deals with the fossils, where he looks at the fossil record and says, look, well, some people have tried to claim that the fossil record doesn't really show a Cambrian explosion, or that we can explain it away by appealing to the genetic data or molecules. And those efforts have really failed, but the Cambrian explosion is a real event in the history of life. It has not gone away as we've studied fossils more and more, and this remains a problem for evolutionary biology.
Wow, that just about says it all there. Casey Luskin, our guest today, will be with us through the remaining segments. We're going to be taking a break here in just a few moments, and we're going to be talking more about the mystery, the deepening mystery of the Cambrian explosion and Steve Meyer's incredible new book on it called Darwin's Doubt. We'll be right back after a quick break on The Universe Next Door.
Are humans the enemy? Should pigs and peas have constitutional rights? The War on Humans, a provocative short documentary from Discovery Institute, explores the growing efforts to disparage the value of humans in the name of saving the planet. The film exposes the efforts by radical activists to reduce the human population by up to 90% and to grant legal rights to animals, plants, and Mother Earth. Watch it free at waronhumans.com. That's waronhumans.com.
Welcome back to the Darwin's Doubt, a special edition of The Universe Next Door. Darwin's Doubt is an interesting title for this new book from Stephen Meyer. It's a bombshell. It's going to be an earthquake as much as Michael Behe's Darwin's Black Box or Phil Johnson's major contribution, Darwin on Trial. This book, Casey Luskin, reminds me of Michael Denton's book, Evolution, A Theory in Crisis, because it's so comprehensive. It comes at this issue from so many different vantage points. It's incredible. Now that I'm into the book, I can see why George Gilder said, 100 years from now, people will still be studying this book. That's quite a statement. And I know, you know, there may be places of hype, but I think this is just a tremendous achievement. And even George Church, the geneticist at Harvard University, has said this is a book which will lead to bridge building, bridges between different science communities. And, of course, he hopes bridges of the gaps. We would say that the bridging will be going into the direction of a new theory. But his gracious response as an evolutionist, it speaks volumes for his integrity as a scientist. As we're getting into the discussion with our special guest, Casey Luskin of the Discovery Institute, I want to just go back and just say that there is an artifact theory that has been clung to, perhaps still in many pockets, many segments of the community of professional evolutionists. They cling to something called an artifact theory to explain the lack of ancestors, the complete absence of transitional forms leading up to those weird Cambrian species that appear suddenly. In a nutshell, Casey, what is the artifact theory and why is it no longer tenable?
The artifact theory is the idea that there were, in fact, ancestors to the animals that appear in the Cambrian explosion, but they were simply too small or too soft-bodied to have been fossilized. So basically, we call this the artifact theory because we're saying that the Cambrian explosion is simply an artifact of an incomplete fossil record. It's not a real event that actually happened. There was no explosion of animal life. It's simply sort of a byproduct of the imperfection of the fossil record. And there are a number of reasons why the artifact theory has been rejected now by many Cambrian paleontologists and why it really fails. First of all, there's the claim that the ancestors to the Cambrian phyla were simply too small or too soft-bodied to have been fossilized. Well, the problem is that soft-bodied fossils are actually quite common in the Cambrian period and even sometimes in the Precambrian fossil record. So let's talk about the Cambrian period. The Cambrian explosion itself is full of beautifully preserved soft-bodied fossils, many of which are quite small. Now, these are, of course, different animal phyla that are appearing abruptly in the Cambrian. So what they tell us is that if an organism is small and soft-bodied, that does not necessarily mean it won't be fossilized or we won't have a record of it. So it's not a very good excuse for why we don't find those ancestors. Now, what about the Precambrian fossil record? Well, it turns out that there are Precambrian fossils. They're just not the type of animal fossils which could have served as ancestors to what we see in the Cambrian period. For example, there are, in the Precambrian fossil record, we see lots of bacteria fossils. There are these things called stromatolites that are bacterial mats that are very soft-bodied. I mean, obviously, bacteria are incredibly mushy and gushy, and yet they can leave fossils.
I like the description, mushy and gushy. Can I use that in my classes now?
Yeah, it's a technical term. term. Feel free to use it. But obviously, bacterial mats are not going to fossilize very well, but yet they do leave fossils. And so the idea that just because something was, again, soft body that we wouldn't find in the Precambrian period, that doesn't hold up. In fact, what they have found is that in some Precambrian rocks, there are actually some microscopic embryos of sponges. So we're talking about some of the smallest and softest types of fossils you could imagine, and yet we find them in the Precambrian strata, and these obviously could not serve as ancestors to the Cambrian explosion animals, but yet we find them in the Precambrian rocks. So what this tells us is that if there had been ancestors to the Cambrian animals swimming around in the Precambrian oceans, we should be finding a record of them, and instead, we don't find a record of them. And that's a real problem for people who want to say the Cambrian explosion isn't real.
Today with us on the phone from his office out in Seattle, Washington, Casey Luskin, who is a right-hand research assistant to Stephen C. Meyer. Dr. Meyer, practically speaking, directs the daily research activities of the Center for Science and Culture, and he is actually one of the leading lights in scientific research pertaining to that huge debate and ongoing debate between neo-Darwinism and the intelligent design movement. In this book, Casey, I find so many really exciting breakthroughs here, and one of them that I was completely unaware of is how the whole idea of the tree of life has come under tremendous pressure from the study of molecules. I mean, the chapter that Dr. Meyer has put together, The Animal Tree of Life, Chapter 6, was exhilarating, to put it mildly, to me, because it showed how many of these studies where they take different DNA sequences or protein letter sequences, the amino acid sequence in different proteins, and they try to construct a tree, and the trees, depending on what kind of molecule you're using, the trees conflict with each other. Is that a fair characterization?
It's a very fair characterization, and I think that that was one of the surprises that Dr. Meyer encountered when he started writing this book, because what he found is that some people would acknowledge, okay, look, the fossil record does not support the idea that there were Precambrian ancestors to the Cambrian explosion. But maybe we can find other types of evidence that show that these ancestors existed. And so people would start to look at the DNA evidence and they'd say, well, look, we can construct, or we're going to be able to someday construct, these grand phylogenetic evolutionary trees using DNA. And this shows that all of these animal phyla are related. And this shows that there must have been ancestors swimming around in the Precambrian oceans, if only for some reason we don't find them, but at least the DNA evidence is telling us that they're there. And so Dr. Meyer kept encountering this reasoning, this argument, to again try to explain away the lack of Precambrian ancestors. And he said, well, I need to look at this claim that there really is this DNA-based tree of life for all these animal phyla. And as he started to look into it, and we all kind of, as research assistants, we all were kind of looking at this together, we discovered that actually when you look at the technical literature, the attempts to construct an animal tree of life have failed miserably. And it's exactly for the reason that you just stated, Dr. Woodward. One gene gives you one version of the tree of life, and another gene gives you an entirely different and conflicting version of the tree of life, so much so that some leading evolutionary scientists that study animal trees have started to say, look, we don't think we're going to be able to construct an animal tree. This is just not going to work. And again, they have sort of their ad hoc excuses for why the DNA data doesn't form a nice, neat Darwinian tree. But the bottom line is that attempts to create this grand tree of life to show how the animals are related have failed miserably. They don't get a consistent picture of common ancestry from the genetic data, so they can't construct sort of one grand tree of life, which is what they'd hope they were going to be able to do. And this has been a very, I think, significant finding of the book Darwin's Doubt.
I'm reading here on page 124. On my page, I just showed it to Bill Carl here in the studio. I wrote the words fantastic, key, wow, with three exclamation marks after it, whoa, and then bombshell stuff. That's just on two pages. And let me just read one quote that I think is fantastic and let you make a quick 20-second comment. Meyer says, my point in summarizing these disputes is simply note that the molecular and anatomical data commonly disagree. And then he adds that one can find partisans on every side, that the debate is persistent and ongoing, and that therefore the statements of, and then he names several neo-Darwinists, the statements of Dawkins, Coyne, and many others about the evidence supporting a single unambiguous animal tree are manifestly false. Whoa. And then he adds over on the other side, the incongruence between phylogenies derived from morphological versus molecular analyses between trees based on different subsets of molecular sequences has become pervasive. In other words, this isn't just a minor problem. It's everywhere. It's just incredible.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's not just the case that one gene-based tree will conflict with another gene-based tree. Gene-based trees will conflict with trees based upon anatomical characteristics. And this is where you get some bizarre results, where if you look at, say, the way that an organism grows, the way that it grows and molds over time versus, say, the way that its sex cells are formed, you will find that there are strikingly different trees that come when you study these different anatomical or physical characteristics of an organism. And yeah, this problem is not just limited to one or two characteristics. As you noted, it's pervasive. As we have studied more and more about the gene sequences and anatomical characteristics of the different types of animals that are out there, the problem has gotten worse. Our inability to construct a grand tree of life for how the various animal groups are related,
yes,
it has gotten more and more problematic.
Yes, and with that, we'll take a quick break on The Universe Next Door. More with Casey Luskin in a moment. And we are back running fast through an exciting book. It's a breakthrough of mammoth colossal proportions. It's Darwin's Doubt. It just came out. It's available everywhere on the internet. I hope they sell 100,000 copies of this in the first couple of months. It deserves it. The publisher is Harper One. It's an imprint of HarperCollins Publishers. They're, I think, based in San Francisco, if I remember correctly. And they are doing a lot of good promotion of the book. Some of the Darwinists are really upset with Harper One that a secular publisher would be so excited about the potential of this book that really explains the case for intelligent design from the Cambrian explosion. It's subtitled after the Darwin's Doubt title. It's subtitled The Explosive Origin of Animal Life and the Case for Intelligent Design. The Trinity College fossil display has just now included for the first time some of those beautiful yellow shale fossils from the Chengjiang Formation of southern China. We actually have a gorgeous trilobite from that formation. So, Casey, next time you're out here in Clearwater, I'll give you a little tour of that display. Let's talk about your work in the book has entailed so much research, so much fact-checking, working alongside Dr. Steve Meyer. There are some of these post-neo, I guess I should call them, Darwinian models, like the Evo-Devo, evolutionary developmental theory. The other model that I know I've written about in my own work, Darwin Strikes Back, Defending the Science of Intelligent Design, my 2006 book, I wrote about Stuart Kaufman and the self-organization idea that, well, maybe these things are just predestined in the chemistry. How do you see some of these escape routes lining up, and what blocks people from really putting a lot of hope and confidence in these post-Darwinian theories? Maybe share one or two of these theories and explain how it's not really holding up too well for them.
Sure. Well, I think what gives people confidence in these post-Darwinian theories is they've been forced to recognize, in their own minds at least, that neo-Darwinian theory has failed, and they know that there must be some materialistic explanation for how the animals formed. Therefore, one of these non-Darwinian models must be true. Now, the one model that they aren't willing to consider is intelligent design. So what they're doing is they're abandoning Darwinism. And this idea that we live in this post-Darwinian world where scientists are now realizing that Darwinian theory just doesn't work anymore, that didn't originate with us. We actually read a number of scientists who have written peer-reviewed papers talking about the failures of Darwinism. Simon Conway Morris, one of the leading Cambrian paleontologists, he wrote a paper in the journal Current Biology a couple years ago where he said we now live in a post-Darwinian world where Darwinian theory no longer can serve as the best explanation.
Wow.
So what are we going to do? So this idea is not coming from us. So we live in this post-Darwinian world where there's sort of all these different models that are competing to explain this data that no longer can be explained by Darwinian theory. What are some of these models? You mentioned Evo-Devo or self-organization. Those certainly are a couple of, I think, very major contending models. They've been around for a while. Self-organization has been around since the early 1990s. The idea that you can sort of get complex order for free, so to speak, just by tweaking a few genes here and there, magically almost, you'll get
radically new systems that appear. The problem with self-organization, of course, is that it hasn't produced the goods that it's promised to produce. There are no studies showing that by slightly tweaking, you know, a gene or two here and there, you suddenly can get radically new complex features. Same goes for EvoDevo. EvoDevo said that by having mutations in genes that regulate the development of an organism very early in an organism's development, at the early embryo stages, that by changing those genes, you can have radical changes that affect the final body plan that is formed. And the problem with EvoDevo is that when you do actually get mutations that can change the body plan of an organism, they are always lethal. So you don't actually find genes where you can slightly tweak a gene and then get this radical change in an organism without killing it. But when you do have genes or mutations that don't kill the organism, those changes tend to be almost trivial to the extent of being really irrelevant to explaining how new body plans can arise. So EvoDevo and self-organization have not worked for explaining how you're going to get new body plans. Other models include the neutral theory of evolution, the idea that natural selection is no longer the guiding force driving evolution, but sort of neutral mutations that have no particular effect at the time, but then later can accumulate and eventually just sort of for no apparent reason actually build a complex feature. And the idea is that by sort of taking natural selection out of the equation, genes are more free to mutate and accumulate mutations. And the problem here again is that without natural selection, you have no particular reason for anything complex and functional to ever arise. So these new models of post-Darwinian evolution, in some ways, actually think they fail even more so than Darwinian theory to explain how new body plans can arise. And Dr. Meyer goes through these models in the book. I think this is one of the most valuable contributions of the book, is that he surveys the landscape of these post-Darwinian models and helps the reader sort of make sense of this post-Darwinian world that we live in today and why it, too, is not going to solve the problem of new animal form.
Well, as you're talking about this whole issue of the alternative models, the escape routes, if you will, from this dilemma, the Darwin's dilemma that is seen in the Cambrian explosion, I'm seeing where even the ideas that are invoked sometimes by Scott Gilbert, I see on page 287. By the way, Scott Gilbert has written a letter privately to us in the C.S. Lewis Society office in which he considered some of the work of the intelligent design movement and spoke of it, I would say, in a surprisingly respectful, not agreeing, but at least in a surprisingly respectful way. And yet so many of these ideas that have come from Gilbert and his colleagues that have tried to solve the problem of the origin of form by invoking mutations in genes, the Hox genes, has really not gone anywhere. They've raised questions about the adequacy of the current mechanisms, and therefore it's putting stress on their own research. It's like, produce the goods or we're going to turn somewhere else, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. And yeah, you're right. Gilbert is a scientist who admitted, actually, that the origin of species, Darwin's central problem, remains unsolved. And so he's just one of many scientists that are acknowledging that Darwinian theory is failing to explain the origin of new complex animal body plans. And again, this is not something that we're coming up with. You can see this in the technical literature. And I think that this points at one of the main themes throughout Darwin's Doubt, which is that when you actually look at the technical literature, you look at what scientists are saying in their journals, in their scientific books, you see that they will readily admit that the evolutionary explanation of the origin of complex animal body plans has not been solved, and they have not explained that yet. And I think that that's probably one of the most significant point to come out of Darwin's Doubt.
And of course, the work that Dr. Gills and I were able to put together, The Mysterious Epigenome, where we looked at epigenetic mutations, that, I guess, invoked sometimes as, well, maybe that's where we can find an escape route or, you know, some solution to this problem. Maybe that's where mutations are really not happening so much in the genes as outside the genes. But we got about a minute left here. Would you not agree that in a way epigenetics doesn't really pave out in front of them an escape route? It creates new barriers.
Yeah, epigenetics points to the fact that there is information that controls an organism's development that's not in the DNA. But Darwinian theory is all about mutating DNA and allowing changes in DNA to be heritable by offspring, which allows for evolution to take place. Epigenetic changes don't work like that. They don't take place in the DNA. They operate outside of the Darwinian mechanism. So by definition, it's really difficult to imagine why or how Darwinian theory could explain the evolution of body plans if it requires changes to epigenetic information. information.
So really, in a sense, their theory, if it's gene-centered, is not able to handle mutations that are not gene-centered, in a nutshell.
Yeah, that's right. I think that the Darwinian theory is just not equipped to do that.
Okay. And I know that many people have said, well, maybe we're back to what's called Lamarckian evolution, where there's a feedback loop where an animal is striving and striving like a little kind of a horse-like creature, and it tries to reach the twigs, and then it stretches its neck, and then the next generation's a longer neck, and pretty soon you have a giraffe 1,000 years later. Well, that kind of neo-Lamarckian, the idea of internal striving and a feedback loop, we don't see that really creating new information in the cell. It's only tweaking what's already there. Well, today our focus has been on and remains on Darwin's Doubt, the story of this new book. It's the explosive book about the explosive origin of animal life and the case for intelligent design. We have with us as a special guest the research associate with Dr. Steve Meyer. His name is Casey Luskin. He has studied the area of sciences and the law, of course, as well. He's going to be staying with us a bit longer so that we can discuss in our final segment more information about the explosive origin of the Cambrian animals and what it implies about the discovery of intelligent design. Stay with us. Mr. Casey Luskin, on staff at the Discovery Institute, an expert in many areas, but including, in this case, the Cambrian information explosion. We have in the Cambrian strata not just the explosion of animals, but an explosion of information. What does the author, Steve Meyer, mean by that?
Sure. Well, obviously, in order to create a bunch of new different types of animals, you have to construct different body plans. And body plans are basically the arrangement of organs and other body parts to help an organism survive and reproduce. Well, to get an arrangement of different organs, you need lots of different types of tissue. And to get lots of different types of tissue, you need different types of cells. And to get different types of cells, you need different types of proteins. And to get different types of proteins, you need information in the DNA. So there's sort of this top-down design that we see in animal body plans. You have an overall body plan, which is determined by different organs, which in turn are determined by tissues and then cell types and proteins, and it all goes back to information in the DNA and also outside of the DNA as well, the epigenetic information we mentioned earlier. So the question is, where does all this new information come from? As we mentioned earlier in the show, Dr. Woodward, there are leading scientists now, evolutionary scientists, who admit we're in a post-Darwinian world. And I don't want the listeners to not understand exactly what that means. What they're saying is that they're recognizing that Darwinian evolution has failed to explain the origin of the information and the complexity of these various animal body plans. So they're looking for new models. So what Dr. Meyer says is, well, look, there's all these different models out there competing to explain the origin of new information, and maybe one of those models we ought to consider is the idea of intelligent design, because it could perhaps explain the origin of the new information that we see in different animal body plans.
And, of course, the idea of a post-Darwinian world is one that's a bit shocking to someone who doesn't follow this debate. I wrote about the phenomenon of evolutionists who have abandoned Darwinism as a workable theory for macro, that is, large-scale evolution. Macroevolution, of course, being what we're talking about here. I wrote about that phenomenon in my book, the 2006 book, Darwin Strikes Back, subtitled Defending the Science of Intelligent Design. That book is still available on our website as well, Darwin Strikes Back. It's at a very, very advantageous price now since we have a special offer on that. The idea of Darwinism going into decline and literally going into a crisis mode is nothing new. This was presented in the book Evolution, a Theory in Crisis back in the mid-80s. But it's now become more intense. It's becoming more pervasive. And to the point that a couple of scholars, the group that has met at Altenburg in a little study center near Vienna, Austria, have begun publishing books. One of them came out in 2002, The Origination of Organismal Form. MIT Press brought that book out. And then later they brought out a follow-up book, The Postmodern Synthesis in Biology. Now, books such as these, Casey, are indicative that there are now post-Darwinian. There are non-Darwinian ideas that are being spoken of. And one of them really is the idea of intelligent design. And in this book, the scholar who has put the book together, Dr. Steve Meyer, has presented intelligent design alongside other theories. as competing models. What do you see as one or two of the advantages that, at least according to your thinking and that of Dr. Meyer, that the intelligent design hypothesis has the edge on all the other approaches?
That's a really good question, Dr. Woodward. I think that what Dr. Meyer shows needs to be explained in order to explain the Cambrian explosion is you need to explain the origin of information in animals that produces their body plans. And Dr. Meyer talks about what is a cause that we know of that can produce information, that can produce the kind of complex and specified information which is found throughout the DNA of all these different animals to produce their body plans. And he says there's only one known cause that can produce the kind of ordered, complex, and specified information that we find in DNA, and that is intelligence. Only intelligence in our experience produces this type of information. And it also is the only cause that can produce the sort of top-down body plan design that we see in living organisms. And we see this in technology design, where human beings, when we design technology, we start with sort of the final product in our mind. We want to create an automobile. Well, what are we going to need? We're going to need wheels. We're going to need an engine. We're going to need a steering mechanism. We're going to need a chassis. You start with sort of this top-down goal. You want to produce an automobile, and then from there you go and design all the different subsystems and other components and submachines that are going to be necessary to make that final piece of technology, that final machine, function properly. Well, it turns out that animals are built in much the same way, where all the parts are integrated together to produce a final system that functions very efficiently to help an organism survive and reproduce. So we have to account for this top-down design in animals, and only intelligent design in our experience is capable of operating in sort of this goal-directed, you know, you start with an end goal in mind, and then you design the body plan accordingly. Only intelligent design or only intelligent agents are capable of producing these types of features and this type of complexity. So Dr. Meyer concludes that intelligent design is the best explanation for the origin of the information in the animal body plans that we see appearing abruptly in the Cambrian period.
Well, what if someone says, wait a minute, intelligent design, that's just creationism in a cheap tuxedo, gussied up, dressed up to look good. How do you respond to that kind of dismissal?
Well, obviously, that's a very common argument that we hear from critics. And usually, it's an attempt to dismiss the arguments for intelligent design without actually addressing them. There are two major differences between ID and creationism. First of all, creationism always starts with some kind of a religious text, and then it tries to make some sort of religious conclusions. Intelligent design, on the other hand, starts with a scientific evidence, and it asks, what does the scientific data say? You can read Dr. Meyer's book, Darwin's Doubt, and you're not going to find religion in his argument. You're going to find that his argument is based strictly upon the scientific evidence, and his conclusion is also limited to what you can learn through a scientific investigation. Namely, that there is an intelligent cause that is required to explain the origin of this information. He uses the same methods of historical sciences to make that inference to an intelligent cause that are used in many other historical sciences, like Darwinian theory, for example. So these scientific methods that characterize intelligent design, they're different from the religious methods that we find in creationism, and ID does not use religious sources of information like, say, the Bible, which is what creationism does. So if you read Darwin's Doubt, you'll get a good sense, I think, for the scientific methodology that is used in making an argument for intelligent design.
And if I could just kind of bring out real quickly, at the end of the book, Dr. Meyer is talking about, you know, some of the other thoughts. He brings in a little bit of a discussion and a friendly critique of the ideas of Francis Collins, who seems to want to embrace both Darwinism and Christian theism. But then he brings out a closing statement, if I can read this. The theory of intelligent design is not based upon religious belief, nor does it provide a proof for the existence of God, but it does have faith-affirming implications. And I think that's a very carefully and wisely chosen phrase. It has faith-affirming implications precisely because it suggests the design we observe in the natural world is real. Wow. The design that we observe in the natural world is real, just as a traditional theistic view of the world would lead us to expect. Of course, that by itself is not a reason to accept the theory, but having accepted it for other reasons, it may be a reason to find it important. Well, I want to just take my hat off to Casey Luskin, to you, our guest today, and to Dr. Steve Meyer. And I want to wish you well. I hope that we can have you back on maybe in a month or two, just to pick up a bit of the surge of interest in the book. Is that okay, Casey?
That'd be great, and it's been a lot of fun. And if I can do a shameless plug here, go to the website, darwinsdoubt.com, for more information on the book and including information about how to order it.
Thank you so much, and we'll see you back here next week on The Universe Next Door.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.